G'day and welcome to A Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's A Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Jovina Concepcion Baczynski, who is doing a PhD in nursing under the supervision of Dr. Pilar Camargo-Plazas. Welcome to Grad Chat, Jovina.
Thank you so much for having me, Colette. I look forward to sharing my research.
So glad about that. I mentioned you're doing a PhD in nursing, and a lot of people, when they hear about someone doing a PhD, they think you're on campus, everything is done on, you know, within the campus setting. But of course, our PhD in nursing program has kind of switched to being online. How has that been? And I guess the good thing about that means you can still work, although that's probably not such a good thing trying to juggle the two of the thing, both the PhD and work.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting journey. It's you're right. It's given me the opportunity to actually go into a program and complete it while working, because the reality is, you know, I do have to work. And so I was very fortunate that I was accepted into the program. It's been great. I tend to work independently quite effectively. So this is online learning and there's a good fit.
Well, that's good.
Yes. Yes. The only thing is, you know, as the years progress, you become a bit more isolated. By that, I mean, you know, you're no longer a part of eight as we were. Become a part of whatever too, and then eventually you're on your own at the finishing line, so to speak. But I do miss the opportunity to get together with my cohort.
Yes, I always feel collaboration and that community feel is super important for those of you doing a PhD, because it is a long journey. But as you said, as the years go by, it gets more and more isolating, in which case that's where your community is even more important.
Yes.
For that. But I guess you've also got your own community in your work environment, so you could always sort of bounce things off them. Do you do that?
I do, and I believe it's really important to be so I'm fortunate in that my research topic and my work are linked, and so it's important to be able to do that, whereas if I was doing something totally different, the disconnect would be really, really difficult to reconcile. So I'm lucky I'm able to apply what I'm studying to what I'm working on, and vice versa. So that's an important piece.
And I think that's the ultimate goal for any research, is that eventually it can be applied somewhere. But if you're seeing that application right now, that's certainly a bit of a bonus for you.
It is. And you know, I learn every day where I work. And so I also get to apply what I have learned to my daily setting, especially my research topic, which is quite broad and yet specific at the same time.
So let's get on to that then, because you are working on the kidney supportive care. That's the topic, kidney supportive care. I mean, that's pretty broad. What do you mean by that? Can you just give us a bit of an overview of what you're trying to look at there and why?
So maybe a bit of a background. Back in 2015, I was working as a nephrology nurse practitioner. I still am, in a downtown hospital in Toronto.
And can you just explain the word nephrology, just to make sure people understand?
So we're looking at the renal kidney system, although it is more acceptable to say kidney these days. It's more patient-centered. Renal is a bit more detached. So kidney means you know, renal nephrology. Right. So back in 2015, I had the opportunity to be part of a group looking at, you know, palliative care issues. And so it always bothered me. I have been in nephrology nursing, in kidney care nursing, for the past 25 years or more. And it always bothered me that we don't, as nurses, we did not talk to patients about their goals of care, what they envision their future care to be. And so it went from palliative care to palliative care approach to kidney supportive care, because the lingo these days is kidney supportive care, which essentially means palliative care for people living with kidney disease at the most basic level. That's what it
Right.
means.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about the palliative care, because I mean, having kidney disease isn't necessarily a death sentence, and that sounds really harsh, or is it? Or is it just a long-term thing that will be the ultimate reason for dying?
It depends on how you interpret it. For some of my patients, definitely it's a death knell, because once you hear this news that you have kidney failure, so maybe backtrack a bit. Kidney failure is at the end stage of kidney disease. This
Okay.
is where you require kidney replacement therapy, like transplant,
Right.
dialysis,
Right.
or maybe not neither one. Maybe you were in the conservative care, which essentially means you're being treated, but you're not having this life-saving measure. For some people, some of my patients, being on dialysis 3 times a week and going through the suffering that entails, that is very, that's not quality of life. And for others, it depends on how you view dialysis. For some, it's a treatment. Yes, there's hope, but for others, it may not confer, much more than I have to come to hospital and I need to be hooked up to the dialysis machine for the rest of my life unless I get a transplant. And transplant itself is not a cure. It has its own set of problems.
So, what angle are you coming from here? Are you coming from the patient's point of view in your research? Or are you coming from the nurse's point of view in your research?
I'm coming from the nurse's point of view. A lot of research has been done from the patient point of view and from the nursing point of view, particularly within the Canadian context. There's not much out there. I did a literature review as part of my requirement, and out of all the articles that I looked at, that I selected for the review, only one what came was a Canadian study. And even that, the focus was on not just nurses. There were patients, there were multidisciplinary team members within the sample. So really, there's not much out there that focuses on nephrology nurses. And by nephrology nurses, I mean nurses who work in dialysis, nurses who work in other areas of kidney care.
And before going into the what you actually did again, so you're looking at the nephrology nurses, are you looking at their training for the tasks? Are you looking at the emotional side of what they're going through? Are you looking at how they can be trained to be more supportive and listening and observing? What parts are you looking at?
All of that and then some. So the approach that I took, which is a qualitative methodology, I chose constructivist grounded theory method, which is an inductive method. By that I mean the data essentially speak for themselves. So I did interviews, and I maybe interrogated is a strong word, but essentially I asked questions about their experiences, what it was like for them to start in dialysis all those years ago, or maybe just recently for some of these nurses, and what does kidney supportive care mean to them? And by the way, nurses, this term is not familiar to nurses.
Oh,
It's
okay.
yes, but the principles underlying kidney supportive care, some of them, or most of them, are practicing without knowing. I went in to look at the experience, and through the experience, look at the patterns of behavior. How do they or do they not engage in kidney supportive care? Through the interviews, through looking at the interview data, and so that gave me an idea. And so the final report, and I put the final in quotes. My theory is actually just my own interpretation. It's not the final definitive. So that's the beauty about the methodology I chose. It is subjective, it's interpretive, and it's not the only view. There are, I'm sure if you or anyone else were to do the same research, they would have their own interpretation.
You're looking at their experiences and what they're telling you. So, what are they telling you? Are they telling you that they don't have enough training? Are they telling you, I just don't know how to manage this situation when a patient confronts me with these thoughts? What are they telling you?
The number one thing that came through was that kidney supportive care, and let me extend that definition. There are elements of kidney supportive care, but for the purpose of my study, I looked at the communication part of things, meaning...
Okay, which is important.
Yes, meaning that the conversation nurses have with their patients about, you know, important issues such as end-of-life issues, such as goals of care, for example, and this is not specific to my study, but, you know, what is most important to you at the end of life? You know, what are your goals? What are your values? And what are your wishes for the end of life? Some people may want to, you know, they don't want to be, as my patients would say, hooked up to a machine in the ICU, right?
Right.
When the quality of life becomes, is no longer a quality of life, then some people prefer to stop there for, you know, in a very crude way of saying things. But to go back to what they said, you know, the conversation is not happening. They're not having conversations with their patients.
Right.
It's underutilized. So my theory, I have three elements in my theory. I have three stages depicting this engagement. There are those in, you know, in what I call the transactional stage, where they're mostly focused on the physical needs of the patients, you know, like putting them on the machine, blood pressure, all those. And then there are those in the intentional stage who agree that talking, having these conversations is important, and that the lack of the conversation is problematic, but something is stopping them from doing it.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah. And this something that's stopping them from doing, from having the conversation, has to do with contextual factors. So such as lack of time, lack of comfort in you know, being able to
bring the topic up.
Right, right. And then finally, you know, you have the actional stage, which is the stage in which it doesn't matter what the barriers are, the nurses are able to surmount these barriers and end up, you know, having the conversation, whether by hook or by crook, for, you know, again, a very crude way of stating the matters, until you get to this sort of glass ceiling where, you know, these nurses at the top stage, the actionable stage, break through the ceiling of this lack of engagement and have conversations that are routine. Not mm-hmm. So it's not the exception, it's the routine. And that's what this glass ceiling denotes. So that, you know, kidney supportive care is practiced as it should be, which is, you know, it should not be by exception. It should be part of your care.
I think... just listening to what you're saying, it sounds like a lot of it, that the nurses weren't told they're allowed to have these conversations, because a lot of the times we go into jobs and this is my role and don't step outside the boundaries because that's not my place. There's other people that will go into a job and saying, this isn't in my job description, so to speak, but this is a really important part and I have the most contact with these people. So do I need the training to make me comfortable to have these conversations? Is that what you think along those lines?
Well, it's what the participants have said. So in as much as the research is about them, I also bring in my own mm-hmm. positions, right? So this is the beauty about constructivist graduate theory method. It's that I am co-constructed with my researcher. I come in, I've been a nephrology nurse for the past, like, more than two decades. So I come in with my own, pardon the word, baggage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yes, you're absolutely right, Colette. The research that I've done, the literature review that I've done and confirmed by the findings, nurses want to be comfortable in having this conversation. So to do that, they need, some of them or most of them have said, you know, why don't we have a template, like a script? Right? That it's more than just teaching them in a classroom. It's very specific to give me a script. And so that came loud and clear that they want that something, you know, I guess concrete, something that they can rely on to have the conversation, because it can be difficult, such conversations, scripted or not.
Yeah. But it's also, if it's scripted, then in a way they're still following guidelines, as opposed to using their own words, which at times can be construed differently, you know, if they come in at the wrong time to with this discussion, because timing of when you bring this up with a patient must be crucial as well.
It is. And there is a thought that, you know, some patients may not be too receptive to having these discussions because, you know, they're still at the early stage of the disease. Why are you talking to me when I feel well?
Yeah.
Right. Versus someone who's at the end stage, the conversation is interpreted differently. But, you know, but that's from the patient side.
Right.
From the nurse's side, some, you know, there's something in that seeping into, I guess, the psyche of the nurses that, you know, this patient is looking well. Why am I, you know, having this conversation versus someone who's bedbound, right?
Right.
But yes, so that came through the research.
Because I've always felt that, you know, particularly in a hospital setting and things, it's the nurses that do all the observing because they're around more. And, you know, I always feel doctors go and talk to a nurse because they're seeing them each day. They're seeing how patients are behaving, et cetera, et cetera. So
yes, we have the most contact with our patients, and particularly in dialysis, it's the most routinized care in healthcare. Patients are there for, you know, three, four hours a day, three times a week. When I was on the floor, sometimes I saw my patients more than I did my own family. And, you know, multiply that by weeks, months, years. So there's that connectedness, whether, you know, you want it or not, it exists.
It's there.
It's there.
So with all this that you're researching, and I love the diagram that you gave me, thank you. So that was, unfortunately, people on the air can't see it, but it's a lovely diagram and really explained those areas like the transactional, the intentional, and the actional, and then, you know, breaking that glass ceiling. So what do you think are the implications of a lack of or delayed engagement in kidney supportive care for both the nephrology nurses and the patients receiving dialysis? I mean, you've kind of mentioned some of it, but, you know, moving forward, what did you think is what do you think are the implications?
So to answer that question, I sort of have to contextualize the problem. So kidney disease affects 1 in 10, roughly, in Canada or
that's a lot.
In the world. And it has, you know, it's associated with significant morbidity and mortality, you know, across the board. And so the main thing that comes out of this is that if you don't have the conversations, you don't know what your options are. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you don't know your options, you may receive care that is not congruent with what you want.
Right.
Particularly if you have compounding issues such as dementia, right? So in a patient with dementia, usually it's the family who assume care. They're the substitute decision makers. So unless the patient with dementia clearly stated when they were still of sound mind that they do not want dialysis, and yet here they are, you know, a few years later, they are undergoing dialysis. And essentially, you know, one of the participants, and it stuck in my mind, she said, "Why are we dialyzing dead people?" Right? So someone with dementia, frailty, maybe, you know, may not be responsive coming in to the dialysis unit, you know, just lying in bed. And then we're dialyzing this because the patient's family want it. Not necessarily. So, you know, the bottom line is that you are not getting the care that is in line with your values, with your wishes and your goals. And this speaks to advanced care planning, of course, which is where we express those wishes with, you know, our family members at a time when we're still able to, right? Because knowing maybe for some 10 years down the road, they may not be. So it's really important to have this conversation. You know, patients may die in hospital. They may, you know, say they may have wanted to not even start dialysis, which is conservative care.
Right.
So your options are quite limited. And kidney failure is associated with a lot of problematic symptoms. So for some, these symptoms may be prohibitive. And so, you know, if we can provide, and I always think, you know, what would your, in my case, my own father was on the verge of dialysis. He passed away just before we got to that point. But I often ask myself, what would I have done if my father was on that chair?
Right.
Right. So always, you know, situate, you know, conceptually and ethically, that's, or morally even, that, that, you know, that, that underscores this lack of option, lack of knowing what's available to you. That probably is, you know, what is the most important. I mean, you know, there are, you know, statistics out there about, you know, the percentage of deaths occurring for patients receiving dialysis, that so there are statistics, but I wanted to get to the granular level of what can happen if you're not given the option, because you didn't have the conversation.
And so, using some of the methods that you chose, this grounded, what do you call it, grounded theory method.
Yes.
Why that? I mean, clearly it's helped your study, but why did you choose that? There were so many other ways that you could have done it.
Yes. So it goes back to, I guess, the PhD journey. For those of you who are still in the first year, you have to do your comprehensive exams in second year. And so when I wrote my comprehensive exams, I initially wanted to do interpretive description, Sally Thorne's methodology, because I had read about it. I thought, okay, let me do this. I know Sally Thorne. And then my committee came back and said, why don't you write a theory? So I hope my committee is not listening, but my heart just sank, because grounded theory is difficult to do.
Right.
But I did it. So grounded theory, I have come to appreciate much more, and I'm so glad I did it, because I've learned so much. The paradigm of grounded theory is that, you know, the ontology it has a relativist ontology, which means that there are multiple truths. It's not just one. It's not just a survey, right? A quantitative survey. It's
right.
Multiple truths, multiple interpretations. And it's also subjectivist in that, you know, it's interpretive. It's co-constructive. I am part of the research that I am studying.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot separate me from the research I'm doing. Whereas if I was to do, you know, like a quantitative method, my value and the facts based that come out of that research are separate. Whereas in what I did, my own values, you know, quote unquote facts or results, were intertwined.
Right.
And so that really spoke to me, and I've come to really appreciate how constructivist grounded theory and I are a good fit. Now, grounded theory has other variations, most notably Glaser and Strauss, who were the founding fathers, but they're not constructivist. One is positivistic, which is more towards the, you know, the objectivist side.
Right.
So Sharmaz, who is the founder of constructivist grounded theory, I fit well with the method. Sorry, long-winded answer there.
Well, no, I think it's a great answer, because the reason why is particularly in the area that you're looking at. You know, you're looking at a nurse's experience of working with patients under certain situations. In this case, kidney failure, towards kidney failure, dialysis, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think you can put someone's experience in a little box. And so, you know, to help, I'm assuming you're ultimately trying to do is to showcase, these are the feelings of our nephrology nurses, and they need help to be able to overcome an area that maybe we are not supporting these patients well enough as part of their palliative care. Because at some stage we need to bring in certain conversations with them. And I would hesitant to say probably earlier rather than later, because of the things that you said. You know, if they do go on and get dementia or anything like that, then decisions are left to family. They should be making those decisions when they can.
Yes, and you reminded me, there are other qualitative methodologies that I could have used. Experience usually is associated with phenomenology, but grounded theory, I wanted to understand the process. What is happening? And this is like a classic grounded theory question. What is happening in you know with these nurses at the bedside? And that's what I wanted to get at, the process of the engagement as they described to me. And it's very important to understand that this is from their perspective, in as much as I am part of from their perspective. So, you know, the nurses I've interviewed, you know, they're asking for, I guess, help essentially, you know, giving them the tools to be able to practice kidney supportive care, like scripts.
So what is the next step then? I know you didn't interview thousands of nephrology nurses. So what are the next steps to help nephrology nurses moving forward?
That is the $64 trillion question. Not even a $64,000 question.
No.
It's magnified. Those things came out of the data. I didn't go in thinking, you know, what specifically, what how we can help, although that was part of it, right? But what the nurses have said really rang true. And what are the next steps? So many levels, you know, societal levels. We need to be able to be comfortable talking about, you know, palliative care or kidney supportive care in nephrology specifically. So there's a societal. In terms of the practical, I don't have a full answer. I can give you the implications for education. And that's huge. In order to do that, I sort of have to go back to the ground. I am presenting my findings at upcoming Canadian Nephrology Nurses Association meeting in October, and presenting to them and to stakeholders. In Ontario, we have the Ontario Renal Network, and they're the provincial body that oversees delivery of kidney care services, and they have their hands deep into palliative care, symptom management. And so I would be also presenting that to them. I'm hoping to do a policy paper after my PhD. And that would probably be the first step, is to bring this to the stakeholders, to the powers that be, whether it's the provincial government, whether it's the Ontario LARN, which is in charge of overseeing nephrology nursing education at the college level. So it's doing all at once, dealing with the granular at the bedside, and also shooting for the stars and addressing the bigger picture. So it's very, it's very temporal. Like, I'm looking at the future while I'm stuck in the present, and also looking at what has happened in the past.
Well, I think that's great, because there are a lot of levels to it, as you said. It's not just add this to the training. There's more to it. There's a lot more to it than that, because you can learn about it, but there's still, when is the right time? Who to bring in these conversations, et cetera, et cetera. Are the nurses the ones that should be delivering this kind of giving this kind of information? Probably yes, because they're there all the time, and we don't have other counselors. And so there's all those other elements that come in.
Absolutely. And, I apologize for being a bit vague.
Not.
it's very, I don't want to sound like pie in the sky, because for some reason, the conversation is not happening. It should.
It should be.
But why is it not? So pie, a little bit pie in the sky, but also, I want to empower nurses to be able to have this ability to just strike up a conversation without feeling, constrained by, the culture, I guess, of where they work. So it's going to empower nurses. That much I know for a fact.
Which I think is important, because all the nurses I've known, I've always said, it was obvious they were going to be a nurse, because they have this special way of making people feel good, even when they may not be feeling good. so it seems like a natural fit.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't know if there is going to be, someone should maybe take this up as a research topic. Is nursing a vocation, right? Or is it a calling, or is it something else? But the nurses whom I have interviewed there, it's essentially, they're in for the long haul. They've been there for many, many years, and their hearts are in the right place.
Yeah, which, as a patient, is what you need around you.
Yes.
Someone very positive as well. Jovina, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been absolutely awesome to talk to you, and I do appreciate you sharing the work that you're doing and also showcasing different ways of doing research, because that's always intriguing for me, how people come up with different ideas and different methods of doing their research. So thank you for showcasing that as well.
You're welcome, and you know, I hope that people have a better appreciation of, you know, like palliative care is not just for the dying. Palliative care is for the living. So kidney supportive care is to live properly until
live a better time.
Live a better life. So thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, you are very welcome. So thank you. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFIC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.